He shoved the platter of venison away. Something that actually tastes good for once. Can you manage that? The Atatrox bowed, gave a slight, jerky nod. Once he'd gone, Lord Morbray returned his gaze to Eliana, dark eyes heavy and lidded. Red wine stained his lips. You lie. A frisson of fear skipped up Eliana's throat. She smirked, incredulous. I don't. What good would it if there were a rebel compound 2 miles from here? We would have destroyed it long ago.
It's underground.
And well guarded. Lord Morbray blinked at last.
Ah, didn't know that, did you?
Eliana continued eating, examined the dining room blithely.
Lovely little space you've got here. Nice solid table.
Impressive moulding work.
Did they make it up especially for you?
Fork in hand, she gestured at the nearest wall.
Do they change the art according to each visiting general's tastes?
How many? Lord Morbray's soft voice was an explosion in the silence.
316 refugees.
She took a sip of her own wine.
51 rebel soldiers, small bands, anywhere from 2 to 8 rebels, come and go every day. There are 10 on patrol in the woods beyond the compound, forming a perimeter. 5 roam, 5 sit in blinds they've constructed in the trees.
Ammunition and supplies. Eliana grabbed a red apple from a gleaming silver bowl on the tabletop, took a bite.
Sorry, my friend. I'm afraid I can't offer you more information until I've a guarantee for our safety. Me, my brother, my mother.
Otherwise, she shrugged.
No deal, I'm afraid.
Lord Morbray's gaze traveled across her mouth as she licked the apple juice from her lips, then to her throat as she swallowed, then down her body. Eliana's mouth felt suddenly dry. That wasn't desire on his face. Not the kind she was used to seeing. It was fascination. Raw and ravenous, as though the sight of someone eating an apple was a thing he had never before seen. I could kill you right now, he said, his tongue darting out to wet his lips. If I wanted.
But you won't. I know so much more than I've told you.
She took another bite, made herself watch him as she chewed, despite the apprehension creeping across her skin.
You won't risk losing that information, not now that you know a rebel compound has eluded you for so long.
I know the wolf's plans. A secret mission beyond the efforts of Red Crown. It could turn the tide of war. She tossed her half-eaten apple onto her plate.
Let me help you, my lord. What I ask for in return is nothing compared to the information I carry.
Lord Morbray rose to his feet. He stretched, rolled his shoulders, worked his jaw as if rolling out a kink. Eliana watched, her stomach turning. She leaned back in her chair and picked at her fingernails.
Feeling poorly tonight, my lord?
He moved across the room, sank into a high-backed red chair beside the crackling fire, and watched her. Shadows masked him, drawing dark shapes across his face. I'm still hungry.
There was an exhaustion to his voice, and an anger, thin but simmering.
I'm always hungry.
Eliana glanced at the table, heavy with their supper.
Then food won't help, he interrupted. Nothing helps.
A new silence filled the room. Eliana resisted the urge to move, matching Lord Morbray's stillness.
Come here, he said at last, holding out his trembling hand.
Eliana forced out a breezy laugh, though her heart pounded with a swift, terrible fear. My lord, I'm wearing 2 coats of mud, and haven't had the chance to bathe in—
Shut your mouth, he bit out, and get over here.
She waited for as long as she dared, then stood and moved toward him, keeping her gaze on his face.
Let him know, with a carefully crafted expression of disdain and boredom,
that the thought of what he would do to her in that chair didn't frighten her. She was the dread of Orlean, wasn't she? But she had never touched one of the Emperor's men. She settled onto Lord Mowbray's lap and tried to turn her back on the pain in her heart where Harkon's memory lived. But suddenly all she could think of was his laugh, his wide smile, the clump of his boots on the terrace outside her window. How he had touched her that first time with shaking hands. How he had always held her afterward like she was something precious to be kept safe and warm. Harkon, she thought, fear buzzing in her ears as she placed her palms against Lord Mowbray's chest. Harkon, Harkon, what am I doing here? He had asked her that same question many times, and her answer had always been the same. Surviving. Lord Mowbray's legs were long and bony. The buttons of his uniform jacket strained against his protruding belly. How could he possibly still be hungry? He looked to have gained a good 10 pounds since they'd sat down. He shifted in the firelight. Breadcrumbs clung to his stained lips.
I've bedded many people, he said at last, smiling up at her.
Bloody scraps of meat were wedged between his teeth. His breath was stale and rancid, though they'd only just eaten.
But it never felt good. Not once, Dredd. But maybe you.
He traced his long fingers up and down her arm, found her open collar and toyed with her dirty skin. Maybe I what? Eliana leaned closer, even as her throat clenched with revulsion. She let an inviting smile drift across her face.
Maybe you can finally do it.
And I will. Slowly, Eliana slipped off the ridiculous frill-sleeve jacket and let it fall to the ground. Beneath her tunic, the pendant bearing the ruined image of King Ordric on his flying steed felt itchy and hot against her breastbone. If this is what it takes, for Remy, for Mother, then this is what it takes. Lord Mowbray watched her every movement, his gaze distant and his mouth thin with frustration, as if he'd already decided that whatever kind of experience he craved, he wouldn't find it here. His hands, though, were tight on her hips, insistent. She leaned over him, heart pounding, and let her eyes fall shut. She instructed her mind to detach from her body and tuck itself safely away. It was an excellent skill, one of the first her mother had taught her, and she wasn't half bad at it. Lord Mowbray was a mark, just like any other. She'd get through this as she had many times before. Except this wasn't like the many times before. And when Lord Mowbray exhaled against her cheek, his breath putrid and strangely cold, Eliana couldn't help it. She flinched away from him. Her eyes flew open. Two black eyes met her own. In that moment, it was as though something leaped out of Lord Mowbray's mind and into her own. She felt a charge, as of lightning, reach out for her and grab hold. She jerked in his arms, and he jerked beneath her. And suddenly Eliana was no longer in the Venteran outpost. She stood on the veranda of a palace, overlooking a vast land scattered with snow-dusted hills. Her vision was cloudy, shapes shifted before her eyes as if drawn on the surface of swirling water. She concentrated. Fighting for balance. The world cleared somewhat, a city choked and glittering. Distant neighborhoods spilled over one another, crammed between winding roads paved with white stone. Ivory spires soared to the skies, sunrise poured rose gold over a gaping, mountain-sized pit in the earth. Strange lights, like trapped miniature storms, flashed throughout the city streets. All of it was unfamiliar, and yet Eliana felt a tiny, urgent tug at her heart. Was it unfamiliar? A movement to her left caught her attention. She turned somehow, though her body felt detached from everything around her. She couldn't feel the stone of this veranda beneath her feet, yet she could see the world around her plainly, smell a faint scent that reminded her of Orlean. River water, city sweat. But the air here was cold, biting. This place, it wasn't a dream or some delirious vision. At least she didn't think it was. A figure stood at the stone railing, not far from her, beside a statue of a man reaching for the skies with open arms. There were several such statues on the veranda. Protruding from each of their backs were magnificent wings shaped out of paper-thin colored glass and inlaid with fire-colored stones. Not feathered, these wings, but sculpted from flame and shadow. Eliana recognized the figures from Remy's tales about the old world. Angels? She must have made a noise. Something changed in the air. The man went horribly still, then whipped his head around to face her. Shining black hair curled just below his ears. A sleek, dark coat with square shoulders, fastened with brass buttons over his heart, fell cleanly to his feet. His skin was pale, his cheekbones fine, his mouth full. His eyes were blacker even than Lord Mowbray's. She would recognize him anywhere. His statue stood on every street corner in Orlean. Enormous portraits of him, haughty and impossibly beautiful, hung throughout Lord Arkellion's palace. The Emperor of the Undying. And somehow, though she knew him to live half a world away in Seldaria, he was staring right back at her. Chapter 21. Riel.
When Audric was a boy, I could dismiss his fondness for Armand Darden's daughter as harmless. But now, I see the way he watches her when he thinks no one is looking. We must be careful, sister, to discourage them. Ludivine must be queen. Ludivine will be queen.
Letter written by Lord Derwin, Sauvillier, to his sister, Queen Genevieve Corvery, year 994 of the Second Age. Riel's favorite room in Banegard, other than Ludivine's and Audric's rooms, was Queen Genevieve's private parlor. The queen had many sitting rooms set aside for the receiving of guests, but this was her private space, meant only for her and her family.
"Must we do this?" Eveline muttered, standing bored straight at the parlour door, as Riel peeked around the hallway corners to make sure no one was coming. All was quiet, the air in the castle gone soft for the night. Light from the thin crescent moon filtered through the coloured glass in the windows lining this particular corridor. The glass was a northern tradition, intended to bring cheer into a home during the long winter months. Belbrion, the seat of House Sauvillier, featured so much coloured glass that it was said to glitter like a jewel-encrusted crown when the sunlight hit. Satisfied, Riel returned to the parlour door.
"I'm to undergo yet another life-threatening trial tomorrow, Eveline." She looked guilelessly up at the tall, grey-haired woman. "Would you really deprive me of a few moments of peace, knowing what awaits me in the morning?"
Eveline sighed.
"Only a few moments, my lady."
"You worry too much, Eveline."
"I expect that's true, my lady."
Riel held out her hand, gave Eveline a brilliant smile.
"The key?"
Eveline withdrew a small brass key from her jacket pocket and dropped it in Riel's hand.
"I could get banished for this, my lady. Or worse."
"When I'm Sun Queen," Riel said, "you will be head of the Sun Guard, my close advisor, and the most revered soldier in Seldaria. That's worth a little sneaking around, isn't it?"
Eveline's cheeks flushed, her eyes trained on the wall across from her.
If you insist, my lady.
Riel inserted the key in the lock.
I won't be 10 minutes.
Once inside, Riel walked to the center of the parlor, sat on a footstool and breathed in slowly. Here, in this quiet, her true nervousness about the next day tickled her insides like birds desperate to be set loose from their cages. She had read all the books she was supposed to read, said her prayers, studied with Grand Magister Rosier under the watchful eyes of the Archon. Ludovine had worked with the finest tailors in the city to create yet another marvelous costume for the occasion. Visitors had been trailing into the capital all week in preparation for the event. And perhaps that was it, Riel thought. It was the people who would be watching her that had stirred up her nerves. Many hundreds more than had attended the water trial, if Audric was to be believed. It was the Sun Queen banners that winked golden at her from doors and windows as she looked down from Banegard at the city. She'd seen the banners even at the temples, decorating the libraries, the gardens, the doors outside the acolytes' dormitories. On the fluttering fabric, a crown encircled a blazing sun. Since the last trial, Riel had started to understand, to really, truly feel, that something was beginning. She tried to breathe, separate her nervous feelings from her excited ones, and lock the nervous ones away where they could no longer annoy her. She turned her head to the ceiling and gazed at her true reason for coming here. Queen Genevieve had a soft heart for animals, particularly the gods' beasts of the angelic ages, long died out. Upon marrying King Bastian, she had ordered the ceiling of her parlor painted with an extravagant menagerie of them. There were the fur-crested ice dragons of Borsvall, the firebirds of Kirvaya, the giant white stags of Mazabut, the ferocious krakens of the northern seas, the unicorns of the old angelic lands to the east, the shape-shifting fey beasts of Astavar. But Riel's favorite of the gods' beasts had always been the Chevale, the giant winged horse that the bedtime stories from her childhood had told her lived in the mountains of Seldaria and could fly even faster than the dragons. They hunted game as mountain cats did and were sated for weeks afterward. Riel smiled to think of those stories. Hearing them read aloud was one of the only memories she still had of her mother. If she closed her eyes, she could hear Maurice Dardenne's voice, low and rich, a voice crafted by God for telling stories. So her father had said, watching them from beside the fire as Riel snuggled in her mother's arms, a book of God's beast tales open on their laps. Riel drew in a sharp breath as the memory surfaced. It was one she hadn't remembered before, and yet there it shone in her mind, clear as daylight.
You're welcome, came Corian's voice,
kinder than Riel had ever heard it.
I thought that might comfort you.
How did you do that? She whispered, eyes still closed.
And now you're talking to yourself. Riel's eyes flew open, and she shot to her feet. Beside the windows on the far side of the room, Queen Genevieve rose from a high-backed chaise and considered Riel with one arched eyebrow.
My queen, Riel hastily curtsied. I didn't see you.
She swallowed, took a deep breath.
I apologize. I would never have intruded, had I known you were resting.
I wasn't resting. I was thinking. I come here often to think. The queen crossed the room, wrapped in a grey dressing gown hemmed in blue silk. And you come here often as well, it seems. There was no point in pretending.
Only sometimes.
I should punish you. Or at least your guard. But you are enduring enough punishment as it is, I suppose.
When in the presence of the queen, Riel often felt herself reduced to the child she had once been,
leading Audric and Ludovine on some wild game through Baneguard. The three of them had once burst into the Queen's sitting room, shrieking merrily, right as Genevieve was taking tea with visiting dignitaries from Mazabut. And then, not 5 minutes later, Brielle's father had chased her down, brought her back to her rooms, and shut her away once more. She had never gotten to know Genevieve as well as Audric or King Bastian. The Queen was a sevillier from skull to toe, with none of Ludovine's warmth.
"Please, my queen," Riel managed. "Do not punish Eveline. I'm afraid I rather manipulated her into thinking that if she didn't obey me, I would bring the wrath of God down upon her, once I've been named Sun Queen."
Queen Genevieve let out a small, dark laugh. "Riel, you astound me. These trials are meant to cow you, and yet you make light of them as though they're a child's game." Riel hesitated.
"If I don't make light of them, my queen, then my fear is liable to overtake me."
The queen inclined her head, then settled on a settee across from Riel.
"Why did you come here tonight?"
Riel glanced up at the painted bestiary.
"I like coming here. The Chevale has always been my favorite. It reminds me of my mother, and the stories she used to tell me."
Queen Genevieve considered her for a long moment.
"Are you manipulating me right now, Lady Riel, as you've done to your poor guard?"
Riel blinked in surprise.
"No, my queen. I'm speaking the truth to you. Perhaps I've been too candid."
"Not at all. In fact, I think this is the most I've ever liked you."
"Oh,"
Riel began to laugh.
"Was that so very funny?" "I apologize, my queen. I'm caught quite off my guard, is all. I suppose I need to sleep. My nerves are a tangle."
"It's not that you haven't been a good friend to my son and niece," the queen said after a moment. "It's that you are," she paused, thinking, "cunning, willful, and lovely. It's a volatile combination. It unnerves me.
And now you know I've been keeping secrets from you during all my cunning and willful years."
Queen Genevieve nodded.
"And I wonder what others you might have yet to reveal."
Riel forced herself to meet the queen's thoughtful gaze, one that so matched Audric's that a lump formed in Riel's throat. "Come sit beside me," the queen patted the settee's cushion. "We will pray to Saint Grimwald together, that he may bring you success tomorrow." After a moment's hesitation, Riel obeyed. For a long while, neither of them spoke. Then Queen Genevieve sighed impatiently and took Riel's hand in her own. "A sword forged true with hammer and blade," murmured the queen in prayer, "flies sure and swift."
"A heart forged in battle and strife," answered Riel, "cuts deeper than any blade."
"Saint Grimwald the Mighty," continued the queen, "please watch over this child tomorrow as she fights to prove her honor and loyalty in front of my husband, the king, and his holiness, the Archon."
The queen paused.
"She is much beloved by my little ones, and I pray for her safety, so that they may feel joy upon finishing their day, and not despair."
Riel stared at the queen.
"My queen, I thank you for that."
The queen kept her eyes closed, but squeezed Riel's hand gently.
"I sometimes forget that, despite everything, you are still only a girl, Riel. And no girl should have to be without her mother on such a night."
Riel could no longer speak, her throat tight and hot. But it was enough to sit beside the queen and shut her eyes and imagine that Genevieve's hand was her mother's, alive and unburnt. They had built her a cage, Riel stared out the flap of her tent, her blood roaring in her ears. In a narrow pass between Mount Cremel and Mount Peridor, Earthshakers had carved out a clean, square pit in the stone-riddled ground, 500 feet deep. And the metal masters of the forge, they had built her a cage inside it. It was a cube, black and unfriendly, with spiked, groaning insides that churned like clockwork and shifted every few seconds. At any given moment, half the cube's innards were in swift motion. Metal slammed against metal. The hot oiled smell of grinding gears and the sharp tang of the metal master's magic, scents that reminded Riel of her father, drifted up from the pit like invisible curls of smoke. Somehow, Riel would have to get from one end of this caged maze to the other without getting crushed or impaled. And all while thousands of spectators watched from the stadium the magisters had erected around the pit's rim. She swallowed hard, closed her eyes. "I thought Tao would lose his mind," came a flat voice from behind Riel. "Once he saw what we'd designed for you." Riel turned to see Mirren Belastier, Grand Magister of the Forge, and Tao's lover, when they weren't in the middle of one of their legendary fights. In the torchlit glow of the tent, beneath her wild cap of red hair, Mirren's pale, freckled skin looked ghostly. "It's a maze," said Riel faintly, still not quite believing it. "It is. And Lady Riel," Mirren paused, a troubled expression on her face, "I want you to know that I protested against it. It's unfair and cruel. I wouldn't be surprised if the king takes him to task for it, once he finds out."
"Who?
What's cruel?" Riel barely resisted pleading. She and Mirren had never been the best of friends, and now that Tal's long deception had been revealed, Riel couldn't imagine that would change.
"Mirren, tell me."
A horn sounded, its lonely wail echoing off the mountain walls. The gathered crowd began to cheer.
"You'll see soon enough," said Mirren, before pressing a dry kiss to her forehead. "From Tal," she said simply, and then left her alone.
"You don't have to do this," Corian reminded her. "You can leave. Right now."
"And do what, then? And go where?" Riel asked, irritably. "You're always telling me I don't have to do these things, yet you offer no alternative."
There was a pause. Then, "You could come to me. And we could begin." The shiver that swept up Riel's body nibbled like tiny, hungry teeth.
"We're going to have a discussion, you and I, when this is finished," she thought to him. "I've put it off for too long."
"I quite agree," came his smooth voice.
Unsettled, on edge, Riel stepped through the flap as the horn sounded for a second time, raised her chin against the glare of sunlight peeking through the mountain pass, and let her cloak fall to the ground. The crowd's roar rattled Riel's bones, and she smiled to hear it. Her outfit, constructed from a dozen charcoal and shining silver fabrics, evoked the armor of Saint Grimwald. Long black gloves stretched past her elbows, a snug jerkin and matching trousers boasted embroidered designs that flattered her curves, and the long tails of her square-shouldered jacket touched the ground. On the jacket's back shone the sigil of the forge, two black swords crossed on a fiery orange plain. Silver paint streaked her cheeks and eyes. Ludovine had painted her lips a flaming coral to evoke the fires of the forge. 8 solemn-faced metal masters lined the narrow platform stretching toward the pit. She raised her arms to acknowledge the crowd and made her way to the pit's edge, where the Archon stood with a tiny, satisfied smile. As the door to the cage creaked open, the Archon extended his arm toward it.
You can choose to save them. Or not. What really matters is saving your own skin.
He turned to her, blinked twice.
Isn't it?
Save them. Rielle peered into the cage, and when she saw to whom the Archon was referring, the sudden rise of dread made her stagger. Three tiny cages rose slowly from the maze's teeming cogs. Inside each stood a child, wailing in fear. As the crowd began to notice them, shouts of anger and horror arose from the stands. "Are you mad?" Rielle cried.
"They are orphans from the low streets," the Archon explained. "No one will miss them when they're gone. Except, well," he glanced up at the furious crowd. "They might, I suppose."
Understanding sank into Rielle like a slowly twisting blade. The maze was deadly enough as it was. She would have to fight hard to survive it, and to save three children on top of that seemed impossible. But if she didn't? She glanced up at the bellowing crowd. The Archon's smile grew.
"Your move, Lady Rielle," he said.
Rielle did not hesitate. She turned, flung off her stiff coat, raced to the waiting door of the cage, and jumped inside. Chapter 22. Eliana. The Emperor is a hunter that never tires, a storm that never sleeps. How do we best such a creature? The answer is simple. We cannot. If the entire world turned as one to destroy him, again he would rise, and again, and again. The word of the prophet.
"Who are you?"
Eliana startled to hear the Emperor's voice. She'd imagined it before, entertained wild fantasies of storming his palace in Seldaria and slitting his throat before he had the chance to talk her out of it. Whispered conversations in Lord Arkellion's palace had told her the Emperor's voice could worm its way inside your mind and heart, make you helpless to resist doing whatever he suggested, which Eliana had long ago decided was nonsense. A voice couldn't control you. Anyone who said otherwise was a fool. But never, in all her blood-soaked daydreams, had Eliana imagined the Emperor's voice to sound quite like this. A purpose lived there, beneath the rich tones, resolute and unmovable, ancient and sly. She stepped back, stumbled over an imperfection in the terrace stone. "I didn't mean to intrude."
"And yet you did."
The Emperor approached, hands behind his back.
"I can't see you very well. Can you see me?"
A little. Her vision swirled and shifted. She felt tempted to rub at the air as though to clear a fogged window.
"How curious."
"I'll just..." She wanted to turn away and run, but the inexorable blackness of his eyes held her in place. "I'll be going now."
"Oh, I don't think so. No, I think..."
He froze. Expression she couldn't altogether decipher cascaded across his face. Horror. Joy. Astonishment. Rage.
"You,"
he whispered hoarsely, all the loveliness gone from his voice. In its place was a terrible, ragged longing.
"It's you."
Eliana met the terrace railing at her back. "What?" Swiftly he moved closer, reaching for her.
"Stay there. Where are you?"
A great shudder shook the terrace, throwing Eliana to the side. She pressed her hands against the palace wall to keep herself from falling. And suddenly, the palace, the city below, the Emperor, were all gone. The red walls of Lord Morbray's dining room stood fast and close around her.
His slack face stared up at her, eyes clouded and grey, like the eyes of an Adatrox. She pushed back from him, fell hard to the floor, scrambled away.
"Who are you?" Lord Mowbray asked, rising jerkily from his chair, reaching for her just as the Emperor had done. His voice had been cut in two, part his own, part the Emperor's. "Come here, come to me."
A blast sounded from outside. Eliana recognized it as the detonation of a bombardier. Simon. Remy had told them everything, and now Red Crown was going to destroy this outpost, with her inside it. Despite herself, she smiled, what a budding rebel her little traitor brother had turned out to be. The room shook, the dishes on the table rattled, and Lord Mowbray stumbled. Three of the four Adatrox stationed around the room hurried out the door, unsheathing their swords. A wine glass fell to the floor and shattered. Eliana grabbed the biggest shard of glass she could find, leapt to her feet, and lunged for Lord Mowbray. He saw her too late, dodged clumsily. She wondered if the grey clouding his eyes was confusing his sight, then drew the shard's sharp edge across his throat. Blood gushed hot over her hand and onto her clothes. Lord Mowbray made a terrible choking sound, then fell hard to his knees before collapsing. The remaining Adatrox rushed at Eliana. She grabbed a carving knife from the table and met him beside Lord Mowbray's corpse, kneed him in the groin, then plunged the knife into his belly. She ran past him, flew out into the hallway, and ran right into the muzzle of Simon's revolver. He wore the wolf's metal mask, but even with his features hidden, she could feel his fury in the air like the charge of lightning. Another bombardier exploded, this one closer. Simon grabbed her by the arms as something in the ceiling gave way with a creaking groan, pulled her tight against his chest, and shielded her between his body and the wall. One of the rafters fell, bringing down stone. "This way," he muttered, shaking dust from his hood. She pulled against his grip. "Where's Remy?"
"With Narvi. And so help me, I will throw you over my shoulder and carry you out of here if necessary."
"Why not kill me?" She wiped grit from her eyes. "I'm a traitor, aren't I? I thought you'd blow the place to the skies. And me with it."
He laughed bitterly. "If only it were that easy."
Shouts and gunfire sounded from behind the outpost's walls, and Remy, Eliana assumed, was somewhere in the thick of it. If she didn't cooperate, she might never find him. She shot Simon a glare, and swallowed her anger before following him down the hallway. From behind them came a distant scream, followed by another. Eliana whirled. Inhaling, she tasted smoke. The prison. She ran for it, but only made it a few paces before Simon grabbed her arm. "Unhand me," she growled. He did, roughly. "Then don't run away again."
"There are people back there," she said. "Refugees, prisoners, children. We have to free them."
"We can't."
"Why?"
"Because my soldiers have set bombardier charges around the building. When the fire reaches them, they'll detonate. In less than 5 minutes, this building will no longer be standing."
Eliana felt as though the floor had dropped out from under her.
"You're lying."
"I'm not."
"Well, I'm going."
She started again for the prison, and this time when Simon stopped her, she elbowed him in the gut and stomped on his foot, but he didn't release her.
"Let me go,"
she struggled, twisting violently.
"What do you care if I die trying to save them?"
"As touched as I am by your sudden heroic streak," Simon bit out, "I don't have to explain myself to you. Now, move."
Another bombardier detonated, the closest one yet. A chunk of plaster fell from the ceiling and hit Eliana's head. Pain spiked down her skull. She swayed, tried to move forward, stumbled. With a curse, Simon caught her, thrust his gun into her hands, and scooped her easily into his arms.
"If someone comes at us," he ordered, "shoot them."
He ran, keeping his head tucked over hers. Clouds of dust, smoke, and grit fogged their way. Eliana coughed against Simon's chest, considered shooting him in the gut right then and there. But then two Adatrox ran out of the shadows. Eliana turned in Simon's arms and fired 5 times. She was a bad shot, even without having been hit in the head, but luck helped at least 2 of her bullets hit true. The Adatrox jerked and fell. They turned a corner, and another, past a room crackling with flames, and another, where a glassy-eyed Alatrox lay on the threshold, his arm outstretched. Papers marked with muddy boot prints littered the floor. Then, a shot from behind them, a near hit. Eliana looked past Simon's shoulder, and her stomach lurched with fear. Lord Mowbray! He was alive! He chased them down the corridor, rifle in hand, and though his face, neck, and jacket gleamed with blood, Eliana could see no wound on his throat. Impossible. She pointed the revolver past Simon and fired, but nothing happened.
You used all the goddamn bullets!
Simon kicked open a door in their path 3 times before it gave. Once through, he kicked it back shut. Lord Mowbray fired again. The door's wood splintered at Simon's heels. He lowered Eliana to the ground. They were out. It had to have been near midday, but clouds and smoke darkened the sky. The outpost perimeter wall was aflame. Eliana heard screams, shouted commands. Simon pulled her along awkwardly, his arm around her waist as they ran. Oh, right, Eliana thought, giddy, the pain in her head now completely gone, her limbs strong and steady once more. I'm supposed to be hurt. She leaned into Simon's body, let him help her along. A chorus of high-pitched whines began behind them. The door through which they'd exited burst open. Eliana saw Lord Mowbray search through the smoke, spot them, raise his gun. The whines escalated, shrill and dissonant. Simon shoved Eliana ahead of him.
Get down!
She obeyed, skidding down a white slope into a narrow, swampy ravine. Simon threw himself down after her and covered her body with his own. The world exploded. Someone slapped her. Eliana surged awake with a gasp. How long?
3 seconds, came Simon's impatient reply. Get up!
She obeyed, then froze. A terrible sound floated down to her from the blackened sky. Screams. She climbed the ravine, slipping on the slick wall of mud, and peeked over the rim into chaos. The outpost's main building lay mostly in ruins, debris scattered as far as she could see, and from the ruins came those screams. Agonized. Beastly. The prisoners, Eliana whispered. She looked over at Simon. Some could still be alive.
Yes, Simon agreed. Or it could be Adatrox. Or my own soldiers, who didn't get out in time.
Eliana lifted herself up by the roots of a watchtower tree.
We should try to help them.
Simon pulled her back down. He began reloading his revolver.
No, we ride north.
Did you not hear me? She flung out her arm in the direction of the outpost. There were children in that prison. They had them in cages.
Yes, and if Red Crown had carried out their raid tomorrow as planned, they would have gotten them out. But you ruined that when you ran away. We couldn't risk letting anyone who'd seen you, or heard whatever intelligence you delivered, leave here alive.
Eliana stared at him in horror.
What?
A shot rang out near the outpost, followed by another. Simon pointed one gloved finger.
Hear that? My soldiers, disposing of the survivors. Listen.
Eliana did, hearing a third shot, then a fourth, a fifth. She reached for the tree roots once more, but Simon pulled her back down and held her close, arms pinned at her sides.
Listen to them die,
he hissed, his mouth hot at her ear behind the cold, hard mesh of his mask.
Their blood is on your hands.
Eliana half-heartedly fought to free herself, but as the shots continued and the horrible screams abruptly stopped one by one, she subsided.
It will consume you,
her mother had warned her. She breathed past the foul knot of shame burning the back of her tongue.
We'll add them to your tally, Simon's voice was furious. Do you even remember how many people you've killed, Eliana?
Eliana nodded, her eyes and mouth dry. She felt shriveled, undone. She closed her eyes. Yes, she remembered.
including Harkon? He'd be alive now, were it not for trying to protect her. What had she told Remy?
We can't know for certain. He could still be alive.
She closed her eyes, clung to the foolish hope to keep from screaming.
87,
she whispered as the gunshots continued.
88. 89.
What did you ask him for? Simon lowered his hood and pushed back his mask so that it rested in a mess of dirty blonde hair. Safe passage home for you and Remy. Amnesty. Your mother returned to you safe and sound.
Eliana nodded. She felt as though, slowly, all the life inside her were being funneled out.
And was it worth it? Were their lives worth it? He jerked his head up at the outpost. Did you get what you asked for?
Eliana didn't have the chance to answer, interrupted by galloping hoofbeats.
She glanced up and the sight of a mud-spattered brown horse emerging from the nearby woodlands. Remy, sitting on its back behind Navi, knocked the breath out of her. She met his worried blue gaze and gave him half a smile.
Simon,
Navi called down to them, a terrible fear on her face.
Crown's Hollow is under attack.
Simon pushed Eliana ahead of him.
Climb,
he snapped. She did, Simon following nimbly. Remy was already dismounting, Navi right after him. Remy stumbled across the mucky ground to bury his face in Eliana's blood-stained shirt. She held on to him automatically, half her mind still back at the outpost with the gunshots. They'd stopped. So had the screams.
Remy whispered. Did they hurt you?
She shook her head, made herself look at him.
No. I'm all right.
Simon grabbed the horse's reins.
What's happened?
A squadron of Adatrox attacked, Navi explained. Shortly after you'd gone. Patrick got me and Remy out, but just in time. We were the only ones. Simon, they've taken all the exits.
Her hood fell back, her eyes haunted.
No one can get out.
Eliana stepped away, detaching herself from Remy, the refugees, Patrick, Hob and his notebook, and Tiny, Lynette. 367, give or take, if no one else had made it out. Plus the 93 she'd reached before the guns stopped. 460 bodies worth of blood, coating her hands a bright, blazing red. A numb feeling spread out from her chest down her limbs, scouring her veins clean of all reason.
El, what is it? Remy asked. Are you sick?
But she ignored him. A movement at the corner of her eye grabbed her attention. Two red-crowned soldiers, 30 yards away, near the smoking perimeter fence. They were picking through the uniforms of fallen Adatrox, pulling out flasks, papers, weapons. Nearby, grazing among the debris, were two horses, bridled and saddled, patiently waiting. Eliana squeezed Remy's shoulders, murmured,
"Stay here, quietly."
And backed slowly away as Simon and Navi continued their hushed, urgent conversation. Then she turned and ran, ignoring first Navi's cry and then Simon's roar of fury, mounted the nearest horse, snapped the reins, and bolted.
2 miles southwest of here, she turned the horse that direction. Wet branches snagged her clothes and the horse's legs carved thin red tracks across her cheeks. Hoofbeats chased her. When her horse cleared a stretch of trees and broke out onto open ground, she dared to turn around and saw Simon, bearing down hard on his horse as he pursued her. Mask on, cloak flying out behind him like a pair of dark wings. She leaned lower over her horse and urged him on.
Faster, you stupid beast!
Then up ahead, plumes of black smoke churning up to the cloudy sky. Eliana squinted through the approaching woods, pulling her horse abruptly to a stop. She dismounted, tied the horse to a nearby branch, and crept closer into a cluster of moss-laden gemma trees. There, perhaps 200 yards before her, was the stretch of land that covered Crown's Hollow. Smoke churned from 5 distinct points, flames licking up out of hidden openings carved into the ground. Eliana recognized the one she'd snuck out of with Remy. Had it been only hours before? 3 Adatrochs stood at every fire, weapons trained on the flames. A larger group, including a lieutenant with a thick gray band around his left bicep, stood some yards away from the compound, waiting. They were smoking the rebels out.
"They've taken all the exits," Na'vi had said. "No one can get out."
Eliana leaned hard on the Gemma tree as she realized what must have happened. Somehow, Lord Morbray had communicated to his soldiers everything Eliana had told him about Crown's Hollow, even though he hadn't left her sight after their conversation at the dining table. But then, Eliana thought, I didn't need to be in Seldaria to stand on a terrace with the Emperor. Did I? Nausea coiled coldly in her belly. Could it be that the Emperor and his generals, his lieutenants, maybe even all the Adatrochs, could send messages and visions to and from each other's minds? How was such a thing possible? Simon arrived, pulled up his horse at Eliana's side and jumped off. He grabbed her arm.
Are you mad, Dredd?
I'm sorry, I thought I could help them. I didn't... I wasn't thinking...
Indeed you weren't. There's nothing we can do for them now.
His voice was flat.
We'll return to Na'vi and ride north as fast as we can. There's a solid rebel presence in Rinthos. They'll shelter us for a bit.
Eliana grabbed 2 of the spiked bombarderies strapped to his belt and ran. Simon reached for her. She twisted out of his grip and raced for the gathered Adatrochs, standing patiently behind their lieutenant. Waiting, as the black smoke thickened, for desperate rebels and refugees to come tumbling out, gasping for air. Her hands tightened around the bombardiers. Her mind was a wreck of noise and blood-soaked images, fanning the flames of rage in her breast until she could feel nothing else, not even a prick of fear, as she pulled the bombardiers' caps and burst out of the trees.
Saint Marzana,
she prayed as she pushed past the back lines of Adatrochs and ran into the heart of their orderly squadron.
If you care for the prayers of monsters like me, hear this one.
The bombardiers vibrated, whining in her hands. She skidded to a stop, surrounded by shouting, confused Adatrochs. The lieutenant at the front of the group turned. His eyes widened when he saw her. He called out a command. The Adatrochs nearest her raised their swords. Others raised their guns to shoot. Eliana finished her prayer.
Burn them.
She threw down the bombardiers, turned, and ran. This time, when the world exploded, it flung her into the trees. She hit something hard. The back of her body lit up with terrible, hot spikes of pain. Then blackness took her. Chapter 23 Riel.
A sword forged true in hammer and flame, flies sure and swift. A heart forged in battle and strife, cuts deeper than any blade.
The metal rite, as first uttered by Saint Grimwald the Mighty, patron saint of Borsval and metal masters. The opening of the cage flung Riel down a smooth chute and onto a tiny platform so small she almost tumbled over the edge. The crowd above let out shouts of dismay. She swayed, regaining her balance. A blast of heat shot up from below her. Looking down, she saw a churning mass of metal, pulleys hissing, swords flying, and fans whirring. Large steel plates crashing into one another, staircases folding in on themselves and transforming in the blink of an eye into long ramps slick with oil. She could not leave this horrible creation without the 3 children. All her effort in these trials would be for nothing. The people would turn on her. But it was more than that. She glanced up through the black bars of the cage to the seething crowds above.
You want them to love you,
Corian observed, sounding surprised. Riel threw her arms over her head and crossed her forearms, echoing the sigil of the forge. Cheers erupted from the crowd in response.
Yes, she thought. I want them to love me.
Then she turned and ran, not for the opposite corner of the maze, where she thought she glimpsed a door that would lead her to escape. Instead, she ran for the child nearest her, his brown face pressed to the bars of his cage. She jumped over a narrow chasm beside the platform and then started down a set of stairs. Below her feet, each step flattened, vanishing as she ran. She was almost fast enough. Almost. Toward the bottom of the stairs, the steps disappeared entirely. She slid down the last stretch, falling forward fast to land, knees first, on a deck of metal grating that careened from side to side. The landing sent spikes of pain up her legs. She clutched the grating, gritting her teeth as her stomach roiled violently.
Please, cried the child, not too far off. This way, please, my lady.
She closed her eyes, struggling for breath. She could almost hear Tal's patient voice in her ear.
The Imperium is always there, every moment, every breath, every inch of life you touch. It waits for you,
Corian remarked softly.
Your teacher is not wrong,
Riel set her jaw.
But the Imperium does not simply wait for you, Riel, he continued. It hungers for you. No one else will ever understand it as you can. It longs for you, the way a lover yearns for his mate.
Riel snapped open her eyes. The world around her began to shimmer. Her fingers curled.
I hunger for it as well.
Darling, I know it. Don't resist. Reach out and take it.
She shuddered, heat flooding her limbs. Stop, she whispered, reaching out for the churning gears with the edges of her mind. The deck beneath her jerked, slowing. She slammed her palms against the grating, tasted its metal tang on her tongue, felt its vibrations up her arms. A gold-tinged wave of energy shot out from her hands, ricocheting through the maze.
Stop!
It was a command. The deck screeched roughly to a halt. With a choked scream, Riel lost her grip, fell, then caught herself on the deck's edge at the last second with grasping fingers.
Here!
The child yelled below and behind her to the right. Riel glanced back over her shoulder, feet dangling. The threads of concentration she'd managed snapped. Silver glinted at the corner of her eye. Metal Master magic? She followed its trail to a winding set of stairs that flew apart into whirling metal plates. They spun right for her, cutting through the air like spinning knives. Desperation gave her strength. She swung her body once to get momentum, then flung herself through the air to the platform where the child's cage stood. The metal plates just missed her, slamming into the deck from which she'd hung only seconds before. Shaking, eyes stinging from sweat and oil, Riel fumbled with the lock to the child's cage. The near miss with the flying plates had thrown her. She could hardly see, hardly think. The child screamed at her, sobbing,
"Hurry! Please hurry! I'm trying!"
She snapped and then saw the reason for his terror. His cage was shrinking. In seconds, he would be crushed. If she got out of here alive, she would tear the Archon's flesh from his bones and relish his every dying scream. She thrust her palm against the lock with a furious cry. Raw power sizzled up her arm and out of her body, knocking the child off his feet and shattering the lock. The metal scraps of it went flying. She wrested open the door.
Come on!
The child flung himself at her and wrapped his arms around her neck. Overhead, the crowd burst into wild cheers. Beneath the din, Riel heard a metallic creak and looked up. A small door in the cage's roof was opening. Two Metal Masters crouched there, holding their arms out for the boy. two more. Riel shoved him out to safety, not waiting to hear the door shut. The nearest child was wailing for her, clear at